Welcome to the Empowerment Zone with Ramona Houston, where we zone in on Black and Brown relations and our journey to empowering our communities.
Thank you for joining the Empowerment Zone. I am your host, Ramona Houston.
Diversity, equity, and inclusion. And if you're in higher education, the term is inclusive excellence. That's what we're exploring today. There are so many issues happening in our country, and a lot of institutions in higher education, nonprofit organizations, philanthropic community, foundations, corporations, all of them are finally beginning to address the issue of diversity, equity, and inclusion. And so today we're going to explore the topic Wages of Blackness, Cultural Taxation and Its Impact on Black Professionals. And I'm excited to have our guest today, Dr. Richard Reddick, also affectionately known as Dr. Rich. And so I am excited to have him today. Richard Reddick is an educational researcher focused on issues pertaining to equity in higher education. And he qualitatively examines the phenomena of cultural taxation, which he's going to define that for us in our discussion. But it's the uncompensated, unrewarded diversity labor that BIPOC faculty, and he'll define BIPOC as well for us, Black, Indigenous, and people of color faculty, students, and staff engage in to advance institutional diversity goals, mentoring across race and gender, and how BIPOC faculty, staff, and students experience historically white institutions. Dr. Rich is an Associate Dean for Equity, Community Engagement, and Outreach in the College of Education at the University of Texas at Austin, my alma mater, where he is also Professor of Educational Leadership and Policy. So Dr. Rich is a first-generation collegian and child of immigrant parents, and he is a community-based scholar. He is a son, brother, husband, as well as a Jeopardy, Wheel of Fortune champion. I never was good at Jeopardy, so I can't wait. At the end of our discussion, I want to hear more about those experiences. But welcome, Dr. Rich. I'm so happy to have you today.
Dr. Ramona, thank you. That was a wonderful introduction. And yes, it's great to be here.
Man, so before we get started on this intense conversation today, why don't you tell our audience about you, your background, your family background and your professional, work. Just tell us a little bit about yourself.
Right. Well, I mean, I always start by telling people I'm an Air Force brat. So I went to 12 schools before I graduated from high school. Which is not uncommon for most of us, right? Most of us have had a lot of those experiences. But the hybridity of my experiences, so I spent 10 years living in the UK, going to American schools, living in Britain. My mother's from Jamaica. I had that part of my identity. So I've always had this hybridized, what my mentor Charles Willie would call marginality, right? Or maybe Gloria Anzaldu would call it borderlands identity, right? So I came to Austin in 1986 and ninth grade. So I started my whole high school experience over here. And, you know, I went to school in East Austin, shout out to Johnston High School out in the barrio of East Austin. And the interesting thing, Ramon, is that I never really, I'm first generation college student. So we, you know, you're smart, you should go to college. We didn't know what that meant. And there was a university 4 miles from my high school that I knew nothing about besides athletics and sports. And I always tell people this, my first visit to a college campus was Texas A&M University. And I was in ROTC and I was impressed by that. And then St. Edward's here in Austin. And then finally UT. And of course, UT is where I ended up going. So my relationship with the University of Texas started in 1989 and has continued to this present day. I went to UT as an undergraduate student, did a lot of things there, really found my calling, was an educator. I taught for 2 years in Houston ISD in the Fifth Ward community. I got my graduate degrees in educational, higher education, and worked in California and Atlanta, and went back to Boston for my doctorate. And around the end of my doctorate time, I was like, well, do I want to be an administrator in higher education? Do I want to do something on the faculty side? And I had no idea what that meant. But I came back here and had a couple of experiences where the opportunity sort of evolved. I came back in 2007 as a professor, and I always say this to people, I came back to a place where I had received D's and was on scholastic probation as a professor. Mm. So the cognitive dissonance between walking past the buildings where I suffered my worst academic experiences and being a professor is still, it still gets to me. It's crazy. But, as you said, my family is super important. In fact, this weekend we had snow in Austin. So we were outside.
I heard.
Building. These kids don't do Texas kids cannot do snowballs. So after I a little bit on snowball building, had to give them a little pepper. We went back to it. But I've been at UT since 2007. And we're all based here. For the first time in our lives, our entire family, my wife's family, we're all in Austin. So it's kind of nice to be around family constantly, even during pandemic. But yeah, that's kind of what I do and who I am and how I got here.
Wow. When you talk about your experience of being a first generation college student and this big, large, impactful university just 4 miles away, and you have no experience, had never been on the campus, and then, not do well, and then eventually get your EDD and come back to serve that institution. Right. That's a powerful story, because a lot of people, particularly first generation students, don't realize that even though it may be a challenge, you still can succeed.
Yeah. You're exactly right. And this is why being a military kid is really convenient, because one thing I learned moving school so much is that you have to get in where you fit in, right? Mm-hmm. We all feel insecure. We all feel that we're in the periphery of things. But at some point you have to say, look, maybe I am, in fact, the person who's least knowledgeable, least well-versed in these things, but I'm here. So let's make this happen. And so even though I'm an introvert by nature, I do have this ability to just kind of say, look, I don't know what's going on here, but I need to find out. Mm-hmm. And I also have the ability to kind of figure out who are the people who can help me along that way. So my secondary research is on mentoring. And so I have been the recipient of such great mentoring throughout all my time, through my UT experience in high school, post-graduate. I've just had great mentors. And that's because I realize there are people who want to see you succeed. The trick is to figure out who those people are. And secondly, to access them. And a lot of times I spend my time talking to, especially first gen, low income students of color, and say, look, you really need to think about who's on this campus. And they don't always look like you. That's the thing people often think. Well, Dr. Reddick, you're a black male, so you're looking out for black men. Yes, I'm looking out for Latinas, Asian people, white folks. I'm looking out for everybody. And so I think one of the tricks is to understand that the help that you need may not come in the package you expect, right?
Exactly.
And that's something that I think that's been part of my success. My mentor tree is massive. And folks, you were like, you rock with that person? That's the person you... I'm like, yeah. Mm-hmm. They helped me with this particular thing and they're really good at it.
Mm-hmm. And that's good to tell all of our student listeners, as well as our professionals, that mentorship is valuable in making sure that you achieve your goals, and your mentor does not have to necessarily look like you or be your same sex or be only in your community or your immediate network. It's a lot of people out there who want to see you succeed who are from diverse backgrounds.
Right.
Well, with that being said, I want us to go straight into our topic on the wages of Blackness, cultural taxation, and its impact on Black professionals. So tell us, first of all, let's define these terms. You have this BIPOC term and what you mean by cultural taxation. And let's get into this conversation. I can't wait to hear your perspective on all of this.
Oh, sure. Okay. So first of all, let's start with BIPOC. And BIPOC stands for Black, Indigenous, and People of Color. And that is a terminology. So people understand the term minority, right? You know, if you're from the 70s and 80s, like I am, you probably grew up hearing that term minorities, people of, you know, minority people. Then we move to a term, people of color, which is more inclusive, right? Because first of all, most of us numerically are no longer in the minority. Mm-hmm. Here in the state of Texas, Latinos are no longer a minority, right? So it's actually inaccurate, right? It's when you talk about population numbers. The other piece is, why do we talk about BIPOC versus people of color? Because we want to actually prioritize and identify the oppression and the genocidal nature of experiences of Black people worldwide and Indigenous people worldwide, right? Indigenous people being Native Americans here in the United States, but they can be Indigenous people to Australia, mm-hmm. other parts of the world. There has been a continual effort to eliminate people of these identity groups. And so the prioritization of those two identities, Black and Indigenous, makes people understand that there's something, we talked about this a little earlier, about anti-Blackness. There is something about those experiences that sort of needs to be pulled out as being distinct. People of color, of course, refers to all of us who are non-white. And actually, you can look at the sort of, you know, language charts, and as soon as George Floyd and Ahmaud Arbery and Breonna Taylor happened this summer, you start seeing those terms increase, because now people are saying these are issues that are impacting Black and Indigenous communities in particular, as well as people of color. So it's a more inclusive term and more specific, identifying those groups that have experienced oppression.
You know, I would even push back a little bit on the definition, instead of saying prioritize Black and Indigenous, but distinguish their experience between Black and Indigenous and other people of color, because there is a distinct, like you stated, a distinct experience mm-hmm. of Black and Indigenous people. But go ahead. Cultural taxation. Tell us all about that.
So cultural taxation is often referred to as, and I want to give a shout out to Amado Padilla, who is the person who originated this term in the 1990s, but we often call it the Black tax, the brown tax, you know, you name your ethnicity tax, right? And that basically is institutions that are predominantly white, like universities and corporations, often are making sometimes performative, sometimes substantive moves towards equity and inclusion, right? And that depends on the labor of people of color, BIPOC people in those organizations. So you get tapped to be on a diversity committee. You get tapped to head a Black History Month program. You get tapped to translate documents from your language to another. You know, that's what kind of happens. The two issues with that are this, Dr. Ramona. The first one is that labor is often uncompensated, right? You just do it as part of your job. So your colleague who has the same job title as you is not doing these things, right? And oftentimes they're not saying, oh, Dr. Ramona, you know, this is so important to us as an organization. We're going to suspend your other duties and give you this work to work on so you can work on this focus. No, do it in addition to what you're doing. Do it in overtime, do it on weekends, do it after work. The other thing, of course, is that it's a psychological burden to take on this, right? We're not talking about, I often make this analogy to my friends who work in the STEM fields. I'm like, look, when you're asked to lecture on chemistry, there's nothing about chemistry that impacts you personally. There's nothing about that that's subtractive to your experience about, let me share to you how I've been victimized or how I have experienced these things. So when we go and talk about our experiences, we're often talking about things that, you know, are traumatic, right? Our encounters with police, our encounters trying to overcome racism and sexism and homophobia, those kinds of things, right? So that's the thing that happens. The other thing that's important about cultural taxation is that when you get to the point of recognition, recognition can be financial and, you know, pay raises, it can be structural as far as getting promoted. Oftentimes that work you've done is not valued as other types of work. So here you've been doing this diversity work, helping on committees, helping to make the space more inclusive, educating people. And then they look at you and like, Dr. Ramona, I notice you haven't done as much work as Joe Blow has. Joe Blow gets promoted, you don't get promoted. And you're like, I did all this work. And the institution tells you, well, it's nice, we appreciate it, but it's not the same as doing X, Y, Z. And so the institution does a double whammy on you, because then you realize, wow, I did all this work and y'all say it doesn't matter, but it mattered back then. And that leads us to be in situations where we either become very discouraged, we leave, or we just have a complete lack of faith in how the institution is run, because we realize that work that you claim is important isn't being recognized for the importance that it actually has.
So this whole cultural taxation, I'm going to digress a little bit. I know we used to talk about the Black tax when I was growing up, that that products that you buy in the Black community in stores are much more expensive than other areas. That's particularly in the urban areas. True. And so it's very interesting for me to hear about this concept of cultural taxation. So mm-hmm. you're not, the way you explained, you're not compensated. You do this diversity work. You're not compensated. There's a psychological burden because you're talking about your own experience as a person of color. And then your work in diversity is not valued. So how do you propose that people who are doing this work and how do you propose that they address it internally in their institutions to make sure that they are compensated, that their work is valued, and they can do this work without having the taxation? What do you encourage institutions to do to address this issue?
It's a great question. So there's two things. So the first thing in my research, I found most people who engage in this work want to do the work. So sometimes well-meaning people say, well, don't do any, especially in academia, don't do any service, don't get involved in anything. But so many of us are here because somebody reached out to us and supported us. So that work is valuable. It's about and I had a piece that came out a little while ago called Cultural Taxation Without Representation. People want the recognition for the work. So most of us, if most of us have been asked to be on a diversity committee or do some work that's going to improve our work environment, we're like, yeah, I'm down with that. But then the question becomes two things. Institution, what will you relieve me of responsibility-wise? Because you say this is important. If it's important, you'll take things off my plate to allow me to do this work fully. And then secondly, recognition. When I do this work, my performance evaluation and my year-end review, is it going to be reflected? And will I see your appreciation, whether it be financial, whether it be recognition, whether it be time away from the institution, or whatever I need to do to balance my life? I need to see those results. We need receipts, right? But I also think one thing I've realized when I do my work at the Institute for Educational Management at Harvard, we often talk about the terminology itself. People are like, you know, I'm talking to academic managers. They're like, you know, I kind of knew this was a thing. I didn't know it had a name. I didn't know there was a body of work about it. And there is, right? And so, you know, Amada Padilla, Geneva Gay, and other folks have written about that as well as me. Yes, this is actually something you can observe. I did a piece a little while ago in Fortune about John Henryism. And John Henryism is a connected terminology. We all know the story of John Henry. And so the idea is that when we take on those responsibilities, there's an allostatic load that we take on that, you know, diminishes our health, our mental well-being, and so on and so forth. And Sherman James, who's a professor at Duke, came up with this concept by studying, you know, Black workers in the South and realizing these Black men who work in these spaces don't live as long, right? Mm-hmm. It literally is killing people. Mm-hmm. And people often say, well, that sounds like a blue collar thing. No, it's if you're a professional working in a space and you've been asked, and in fact, I want to give a shout out to Issa Rae in the series Insecure. We get to see that happen in her friend Molly's experience as a lawyer in a white shoe firm. She's asked to do more things. She actually ends up leaving her predominantly white firm to work for a Black firm because the cultural taxation on her is so great. It's kind of a sidebar kind of piece in the series, but I saw that. I'm like, yes, that's the thing. So anyway, I love that series because it's great. First of all, it's funny, but it has these great little pieces that, wow, we should break that apart and talk about. I would love to have Issa Rae talk about the cultural taxation that's embedded in that, which was never made as a big plot point. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I just think it's the recognition piece, but also the awareness that it actually exists. I think the most gratifying thing when I do my work is when I talk to academic managers or leaders, and they tell me, you know, I didn't know, I kind of knew that women and people of color and BIPOC folks kind of had these situations going on. I didn't know what it was called. I didn't know how to label it. I didn't know how to help. And a lot of times as the manager, you're the person to say, and I always tell people this, when you are asked to take on a responsibility like this, you never respond in the moment. You always say, thank you for thinking of me. I need to go back and talk to my manager. I need to talk to my mentors. And then a good manager or good leader will say, I'll be the person to take the hits. And you can say to them, I talked to my dean, I talked to whomever. They told me this is not appropriate for me to do right now. So they're the quote unquote bad person for saying no. Or they've relieved me from doing these other things so I can focus on this more intently. Those are the kinds of things that I think we can do individually and structurally. And just realize that if you have a concern about diversity, equity, and inclusion, that's not free work, right? People get paid a lot of money to consult on the environmental impacts of your organization, of your leadership impacts. You need to compensate people who do diversity, equity, and inclusion work commensurately, right? The same kinds of things. You can't say, I care about this, and then just say, well, we just did it on the cheap. We asked five people in the organization to do this work after they do their other duties.
So those are the ways, those are some solutions for those of us who've been asked to do that diversity work within our institutions. So what advice, what solutions do you propose for the leaders, the managers, the executives within those organizations? What do you recommend for them to do in order to address this particular issue?
So they need to assess what's happening in the people you supervise. So if you've got 10 people who are who report to you directly, and you look at what they do and you see they all have the same title, but Dr. Ramona is doing, you know, a committee work here, and she's doing this piece here, and it's often raced and gendered. So mm-hmm. BIPOC folks, mm-hmm. women of color in particular, mm-hmm. are often the ones, especially Black women and Latinas, are asked to do a lot of this work. And, you know, we call it in academia, academic housekeeping. It's the nurturing work, the support work that's being asked to be done. So as a manager, you need to know these things. You should not be surprised and say, oh, I didn't know you were doing this stuff, Dr. Ramona. No, you need to be, it's part of your supervisory role is to know, I know Ramona's doing 3 or 4 committees. So first of all, I'm going to make sure she's compensated for that work. I'm going to make sure she has the time that she needs to do that work. I'm going to, you know, and this is a famous thing in organizations, right? When you ask people to volunteer to do something and nobody says anything, you're like, well, Dr. Ramona is always willing to help. So I'll ask her to do it because she won't push back as hard as other people will. And, you know, that leads to an issue called social loafing, right? When you are part of an organization, you just hang out, right? And academia, frankly, is full of people who do this, who are like, look, I'm here to get my grants, my publications. I ain't doing nothing else. Mm-hmm. And I will sit there, look you dead in your face when you say we need a person to volunteer for this, and just look at you like, yeah, I ain't doing that. Mm-hmm. And I'll let somebody else do it. And that is anathema to being part of an organization, right? Part of organizational culture means that we all lift something. And we also categorize the kind of labor we're talking about. Because some committee work, okay, I'm on a committee on, I don't know, celebrations. We do one thing a year. I'm on that committee. I bring something to the potluck. Not the same as being on the diversity committee, right? There's different types of committee work and service work. And also, some of that work comes with what we call visibility, hypervisibility and invisibility. So one of my mentors, Stacey Blake Beard, talks about this, right? So we need to be cognizant of the fact we say, Dr. Ramona, I want you to be on this committee. This committee is a high-profile opportunity. So that's why you're on this. And I'm going to make sure you're compensated for it. But I'm also going to make sure that when you are successful, the whole organization knows about it. Mm-hmm. You know, it will not be a secret, right? And then some work is just like, it just needs to get done, right? And so make sure that's balanced so you don't have people who have this great high visibility committee work and the person who's in charge of travel grants or whatever is just kind of tolling away. Make sure they're balanced. So Carrie Ann O'Meara, who's a professor at University of Maryland, University of Maryland's in College Park, has a whole line of research on academic workloads. How do we ensure that that work is equitable? So we don't have people, you know, because it affects other things. If I can have the time to write grants and write articles and do great work, I'm going to kind of move up in the academic hierarchy. And then you, who are doing this other work, will kind of stay in the same place. I want to give a shout out to UT, because UT has something established last year called the Distinguished Service Academy. I'm part of the organization. And we've recognized faculty who do, you know, exemplary service in the community. And the group of five of us this time, the first time around, are all people of color, BIPOC folks, or women. And or women, right? Not surprising, right? Because that's how it works. But the fact that we've been recognized for this work is really gratifying, because none of us do it for recognition. But then we realize, because I've been doing this work, I haven't been able to do other things. Like, they have not perfected the 24-hour day. It is what it is, right? And instead of saying, well, let's start being reasonable about what's being expected, we just kind of say, well, do more. Even in a pandemic, Dr. Ramona, people are like, do more. And my students tell me, and I realize myself, it takes three times as long to do something virtually via Zoom and via email than it does to do it face-to-face. Then we haven't really had that conversation about, we need to have expectations that are about preserving your sanity and making sure that the people around you are supported and safe. Because so many of us have a child next door or in the same room with us trying to do school. You know, we have members who are potentially dealing with illness, especially BIPOC folks, where we know that this pandemic has impacted our communities even more intently. Those are the kinds of things we need to be thinking about, instead of just saying full speed ahead, you know, let's keep chugging along.
You know,
take time to make sure we're okay.
Those are great solutions for leadership, that you've got to know what your people are doing in order that you can make sure that academic workloads, and I would go beyond just academic, but the workloads are equal among mm-hmm. your the people who work under you, and then making sure you recognize that work and provide high visibility for those people who are performing above and beyond. That's but right. One of the things I would add to the discussion, when you talk about BIPOC and women taking on most of this type of work in diversity, equity, and inclusion, I would even say it has to do, it's cultural, because the groups are more about collective, right, versus the individual. You know, and people of color in particular are very community minded people. So like you stated earlier, most of the time people want to do this work. They just want to be compensated for it. It's not that they don't want to do the work. And I would argue that that's more of a cultural phenomenon, in that it's all about the collective versus just being individualistic and saying, no, I'm going to do what I want to do in my work and not focus on the community.
I totally agree. And in fact, when you talk to folks about cultural taxation, you talk to Asian Americans, you talk to Native Americans, you talk to Latinos, you talk to Black folks, you will hear these kinds of things. Like, we're planted in these communities. You know, we don't get the luxury. I don't even call it a luxury. It would be weird to sort of say, well, I'm here and I got here by myself, so look at me, versus like, if I'm here, I need to be in the community making sure that whatever I'm getting access to, whatever I'm learning, goes back to the community. And so I did a piece called Reclaiming Our Time, looking at the work of Bill Banks, who's a professor at Berkeley. And he made the point that Black scholars are in the academy because of community pressure.
Yes.
People who didn't go to institutions said, how come you don't have Black people working in your institution? And they agitated and organized and put pressure to create things like Black studies or Latino studies or Asian American studies. So we have a community connection, most of us, that is very real and heartfelt. And ironically, it does not come from the academy. It comes from communities. Now, we all know this, right? The wisest people in our communities didn't necessarily get PhDs or masters or bachelor's degrees, but they know, we need your state institution. Why do you not have people representing our community in your institution? So that has to be recognized. And I've made that point to several people. I said, you know, maybe if you're a majority scholar, that's not something you're concerned about. But I said, especially me being a professor in the city that I was educated in, when people call me and say, hey, Dr. Rich, come talk to our students, I'm gonna tell them no. Like, no, I taught you, or my colleague taught you. We know you. We got receipts. Get over to Reagan High School. Get over to Johnston High School and talk to these kids. Exactly. And I always do it, you know, and my colleagues do it as well, because we know, first of all, we either had it done for us or we would have liked to have had it done for us. And then secondly, it energizes us. I always say it's a reciprocal thing. You know, the mentoring part's reciprocal. If it was all just give, you'd be worn out. But when I go and talk to our students or talk to community members about what I've done or what I'm doing, first of all, I'm like, this is work that you're paying for as a taxpayer. So you need to know what I'm doing. And then secondly, I walk back saying, yo, this is dope, right? You know, I talked to five kids who were like, wow, I didn't really think about UT as a place where I could go study. I, you know, basketball, football, I love that stuff. But wait, this is the funniest thing. I talk to the elementary kids, students, and they'll be saying stuff like, what sport do you play? I don't play a sport. I'm terrible at sports. I'm a teacher.
I'm a scholar.
Goes on. Oh, so people like us from our neighborhood can go to UT and work at UT as professors? Mm-hmm. Tell me more, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. I don't know any person in the academy, any Black person I know who grew up wanting to be a professor. Mm-hmm. Somebody came on the scene at some point in time
And
showed us this is something you can do. And I'm thankful for that. I mentioned Dr. Charles Willey, who's my mentor, and he was a person for me that sort of turned that on for me. You can do this, and you can do it in a way and not become something different. You can stay who you are and do this work. So it really is about this reciprocal feedback loop from the community and from those of us who work in professional spaces, that we derive energy and inspiration from the community that we're a part of. And then therefore, hopefully we can give that same energy back in some way.
Yes, and it indeed makes your work much more purposeful, because you know you're not just working for a check or to be promoted. You're actually working to advance the community.
That's right. Yeah.
That you are an extension of the community.
In a lot of ways, I feel I'm the wealthiest person out there, because every job I've ever had, Dr. Ramona, has been a job where I get to actually say I am doing something of purpose. When I was teaching and making nothing, you know, literally like trying to figure out how to pay the bills, and I talked to my friends who worked for, you know, large consulting companies and made a lot of money, and they were like, but your work has purpose. I'm in a city doing a function. I do it because I have to, and I'm making this money, but it's not really feeding me. Whereas I can say I've always been fed in that way. I've never been hungry in that regard when it comes to why I'm here and what I do. I've never to say, what's my purpose? It's always been there. And frankly, sometimes I didn't know what my purpose was, but I knew if I wasn't there doing something, things wouldn't go the way they should go. Mm-hmm. And so that's the joy of being a scholar, being a teacher, an educator in the public space, is that that's what you do. Every day you get to see the impact, whether you're teaching fourth graders like I did or teaching graduate students. You see that impact, and you're doing it as well through the podcast. You are educating and bringing people along, which gives you, I mentioned, an immense amount of pride and joy.
Yeah, I think that I agree with you that life is not all about money. It's about happiness and fulfillment. And the best work is that which brings you all three, you know, that brings you a quality of life, a certain, you know, standard of living that you want to live. Not that you have to be rich, but also brings you joy and happiness, as you have stated, and also is fulfilling. Because you can do work all day and not feel a thing, but the happiest people are the most fulfilled people and find purpose in their work.
I think that's so true. And I was told this by a mentor when I was an undergrad, like, you know, do the things that give you joy, because then you'll be good at doing those things. And then you'll want to get better at doing those things. And then at some point, the rewards will come, whether it's recognition or financial rewards. And it has come. took a long time, but it did come, right? So it's like, you know, I tell to my students all the time, because oftentimes I will tell stories and I'll have a student come talk to me. A lot of first generation college students will come to me and say, well, Dr. Rich, you said this thing and I was really inspired by that, but you know, my folks want me to go into a place that I'm gonna make good money. And I'm like, here's the thing. If you're not happy doing something, you're gonna spend a lot of money fixing that, either by compensating in other parts of your life or through counseling, whatever you need to do. Mm-hmm. Do the thing that feeds you, you know, feeds your soul, and you will find the ways in the system to be compensated for it. And sometimes it has to be really creative. Like I always tell folks of color, especially, like, man, our hustle game is great, you know. People, you know, doing some consulting, people doing talks, people creating things. And I'm like, you know, think about those ways of doing the financial reward piece. So not to get caught up on a starting salary, even though it's a capitalist society. I understand we got to do that. We got to pay bills. I get that. But I also think that we have creative ways of thinking about, well, how could I get my hustle together to make sure that I can do these other things and, you know, frankly, monetize what I'm doing. So I'm able to do the things that give me joy. And a lot of times you have to, I also tell it's developmental, right? Maybe there's a part of your life where it's going to be tough. My first couple of years professionally were tough, right? And that taught me a lot, right? It taught me what I did, what I needed, and what I didn't need. Mm-hmm. You don't need a whole lot when you're 22 years old, right? You can just kind of get, live in a dining room. I did that. Didn't have a room, didn't have doors, but got through that situation and it gave me an appreciation for things today. So I'm very grateful for having that experience and not having a perfectly smooth path, right? It's great to looking back now to say, I'm glad I struggled, you know, when I first got out of college and, you know, had to figure out where the free happy hours were so I can get something to eat. I'm glad that happened because now I can appreciate the things that I can do.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, I am so happy that that you joined us today. And thank you so much for educating us on cultural taxation. This was a fantastic discussion. And I also admire you for all those shout outs you gave. You gave all your colleagues some dap. I love it.
Well, it's a reciprocal thing. Like, it really is because you know, I'll hear on Twitter or on social media, like, yo, Rich, I cited you on this and, you know, shout out to Cited Sister, you know, those women out there, black women out there who are making sure that the work that they do is being recognized. So always, but I will give you a shout out as well. I think this is a great idea. Really enjoy getting into this. I enjoy talking about this outside of, you know, conferences and academic spaces. So this is great. So I really enjoyed this. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you. Thank you for joining me today. And I've got to have you back. So anytime you want to educate our audience on some issue or you want to talk about some contemporary things that are going on, we didn't even get into the elections. Ooh. We just had that whole, it's 1 week today, actually, with the whole Capitol riot at the U.S. Capitol or insurrection, takeover, whatever you want to call it. It's 1 week today and we didn't even delve into that. But anytime you want to come back, I welcome you. And I thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Dr. Ramona. This is great work. And I'm looking forward to hearing more of the podcast. So I'm looking forward to it.
Thank you.
Thanks.
A special thank you to the incredible team of the Empowerment Zone. Terry Ungully, theme song. NADWORKS, digital support. And of course, our featured guest.
If you enjoyed my podcast, please subscribe. We are on all of your favorite podcast platforms. Be sure to rate us on Apple Podcasts too. Thank you for your continued support.